AI, ChatGPT, what can we learn from this new phenomena? Leo, the host of the Jew Function podcast, is here to break it down over a cup of coffee. And are your evenings frazzled? Caroline Bass has the answer that will make you feel like a queen. This is a great episode. Welcome to the Weekly Squeeze. I'm your lovely and talented host, Hanala Music, coming at you from the land of Israel. This is episode 112. I hope you are ready for some meaningful conversations that will nourish your soul and your body. So let's get to it. Okay, very important. If you're listening on Thursday, if today is Thursday and you're listening today, please pray for Levi. There is a young boy going into surgery today. He will be under from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Central Time. The following 48 hours are crucial recovery time over Shavuos. So please add Levi ben Rivka Miriam. Levi ben Rivka Miriam. I'm looking at a picture of him. He's adorable. I'll share it in the WhatsApp chat. Please pray for him over Shavuos that he should have a complete recovery and refuah shelema. All right, the breaking story, Professor Alan Dershowitz. I am so pleased, so impressed with him. We did not see eye to eye on the episode we had, which is fine. As a matter of fact, I think the episode went viral amongst legal WhatsApp chats on how not to debate a law professor. But at the end of the day, he is a good man with a good heart. And as of yesterday, he is suing CNN for the emotional distress Christine Amanpour caused on them when she described their horrific murder as a shootout. Not a shooting, a shootout. And Alan's not happy. As reported by I-24 News, Alan Dershowitz was on their show. He said that he is suing Kristen Amanpour for her slip of the tongue because he does not believe that this was a mistake. He says there are no mistakes. This is a deliberate pattern. So he is taking on this case pro bono. Listen to this clip.
I am taking on this case pro bono because this is part of a pattern that CNN and Amanpour have engaged in over a decade or more than a decade. Amanpour constantly creates a moral equivalence between terrorists who murder people in cold blood and innocent victims like the three innocent victims in this case. This was not a slip of the tongue. This was not an honest mistake. An organization called CAMRA, which documents these kinds of things, has documented a long pattern by CNN and by Amanpour of constantly siding against Israel and trying to create a moral equivalence between innocent victims of terrorism and actual terrorism. They're not mistakes. They're part of a deliberate pattern of trying to create a moral equivalence of events in which there is no moral equivalence. There's no moral equivalence between people who shoot families in cold blood and the people who were suffering as the result of simply being victims of terrorism. So let's wait to hear what Amanpour says, not in a scripted apology, but under my cross-examination and the cross-examination of other lawyers.
If you're clapping, well, you're not alone. The clip that I shared on Twitter went completely viral. It has 500,000 views, with Jews and Israel supporters all around the world saying, yes, it is time to go after CNN. This is not the first time. In an interview with Daniel Pearl's father, Daniel Pearl was an American journalist who was kidnapped by terrorists and decapitated in Pakistan. She had the nerve to downplay the tragedy as something that just happens to journalists. This had nothing to do with Daniel Pearl being a journalist and everything to do with the fact that he was a Jew. She said to him, it's been a terrible time since he died for all of us in our profession to see how many of our professionals have been murdered brutally like he was. That is downplaying how he suffered a uniquely horrific murder. Now, I don't know the details of the case. I hope to have Alan Dershowitz back. Next week, we have CAMRA here. CAMRA is the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. And they have been reporting on all these inconsistencies for years. On Monday, Christine Amanpour actually apologized. Now, I watched the apology and it was absolutely pathetic. It was worse than the initial slip up because when you see her apologize, I mean, you could see it's not authentic. You could see it's not heartfelt. She's just like, I'm so sorry. I meant to say shooting, and instead I said shootout. Well, that's not worth the paper it's printed on, okay? That is not an apology that shows that she actually understands how dangerous it is to compare terrorists to their victims. And that has to stop. CNN has been a perpetrator of this sick injustice for years, and Alan Dershowitz is going to set things straight. Okay, a few feel-good stories before we get to our two interviews. Whatever you like, whatever you're into, we have something for you. But first, this beautiful, heartwarming story that was delivered last week, Erev Shabbos, by Uber. to the home of David Mizrahi, the owner of Ida Pita in Lakewood, New Jersey. He also owns Salt Steakhouse in Long Branch, New Jersey. Now, this is what the letter read. Dear Mr. David Mizrahi, I was a regular at your store many years back, and unfortunately, my Yetzer Hara got the best of me. I started ordering food and leaving without paying. I really wanted to pay, however, I did not have the means. Whenever I ordered something, I wrote down the amount to pay it back later when I had the money. However, it got out of hand and accumulated to a large sum of money. Over the years, it has always haunted me that I owed you money, but Baruch Hashem, I can now pay you the money that I owe you. I'm asking you for mechila, and if I miscalculated the amount I owe you and the enclosed amount does not adequately cover the amount I stole from you, please be meichel me for that full amount. I know I'm asking a lot, but you're a wonderful person, and I know that being meichel me, Hashem will treat you and yours kindly as well. In the schus of your kindness, may you be zeichet to all sorts of bracha and atzlacha, and may Hashem answer all your tefillot litova. Signed with sincere regret, a customer. And on the photograph, you see $2,500 that David Mizrahi donated to Bike for Chai. Talk about mitzvah, gereres mitzvah. That's so beautiful. Those are such heartwarming stories, and they make me happy. Okay, the next thing I want to share is something beautiful that I saw on Facebook from Rabbi Eitan Feiner, who is currently the full-time Rav of Congregation Knesset Yisrael, known as the White Shul in Far Rockaway. Now, I don't know what the question was, but I think somebody asked him, if you could learn Torah with anyone, who would it be? And this is the reply. To tell you the truth, anytime someone's asked me this question, people know that I'm a true Gra fan. I love Sifrei HaGra. What I would first say is that I would love to learn with the Vilna Gaon. But when I think about it, this is not my final answer. My answer is, as people know, I've been married for 27 years. My wife and I have one child, a special son who is currently 15 years old and was born after 12 and a half years of infertility. He has many pictures with Gedolei Yisrael. He is an adorable child, but he doesn't speak. He can't say Aleph or a Beis. He is seriously, physically, and cognitively impaired because of something that occurred shortly after birth regarding his amino acids. It is a miracle he is alive today. The doctors told us he was going to die within 3 days. So if I was asked the question of whom I would like to have a chavrusa with, and I could go with any one person in the whole world, it would be my son. If Hashem gave him a refuah shleima and he could talk, the Vilna Gaon would be my chomi, Moshe Rabbeinu would be my chomi, but I would choose to learn with my precious son. Wow, wow, wow. This Shavuos, take the time, learn with your children, sit up late. It is a schus, it is a privilege, it is a blessing, it is a gift. Let's never, ever forget that. The last feel-good story I want to share, I thought this was really sweet. So a clip goes viral, well, viral here in Israel, where Knesset member Moshe Gafni basically suggested that he would donate some clothes to Noah Kirel. I think the conversation was on the budget and giving money to Jew from kids or secular kids. And he said something like, why should my children get less? I would even donate some clothes to Noah Kirel, referring to her skimpy outfits that she wears during her performances. She was all over the headlines here in Israel for winning third place on Unicorn, for a song Unicorn at the Eurovision Song Contest. And people were waiting to see how she would reply. And I was so impressed because she did not take the bait. As a matter of fact, there was no bait. I mean, she's not Tzanua. That's just the fact of the matter. And the way she replied really showed a lot about her character. She said, I really think that each person has a right to express his opinion. And that's his opinion, and I respect it. Everyone can think what he wants, and that is totally fine. Most opinions are ones of pride and love, and there's also these opinions, and it's totally fine. He has the right to express his opinion. Kol hakavod. All I can say is kol hakavod. You know, we can't get hysterical every single time somebody slights us or suggests that maybe there's room for improvement. That's the way of the world. We're Jews. We're hypercritical. We give techacha left and right. It's something we have to work on, but we do it, and we really do it because we love each other, and we want Am Yisrael to be on their best behavior and to improve and to grow and to reflect the beauty of the Torah, and it's not mean-spirited. It's really not mean-spirited. So I respect Noah for her professional and polite reply, and I suggest that we all do that. I actually shared something on Instagram, and people loved it. And I will share it here. I'm going to speed it up a little because it's an 8-minute clip. I'm going to share it here, and then you can leave your thoughts, leave it in the WhatsApp group, what you think. The first 50 replies on Instagram were positive. Oh my gosh, I love this. This is amazing. This is inspiring. Right on. This is what I've been trying to say. So well expressed. And then the negativity started. it's not factual. This is wrong. It's lies. And I was just like, can you just leave things be? Now, what I'm talking about is a video called In Defense of Haredim. And what you're seeing or what you're hearing is a voice note that somebody left someone, an anonymous voice note that was put over a video footage explaining why Haredim are not shirking their duties here in the land of Israel. So take a listen to this.
There was a left-wing protest in my neighborhood in Beit Vegan, Yerushalayim, today. And we could pretend to call it a protest against the government or against the draft law, like they were saying. But let's face it, the real protest was against Haredim, against Torah, against mitzvahs. And that's why they're going to Beit Vegan, Bnei Brak. The people that they're protesting against have no involvement in the government. This is what they're protesting. So I went at the end. I didn't want to be part of the actual protest. I wanted to speak to people. I wanted dialogue. I went at the end and stopped someone and spoke. I asked, what do you want? What are you here for? And she said, we want all Haredim, all Orthodox Jews, to go to the army. I said, all of them. So you're saying none of them go? She said, well, I said, is it possible that there are some Haredim that go? She said, yes, but very, very small. I said, okay, so just to get our bearings, we shouldn't say all Haredim because you're generalizing everyone when you just said that there are Haredim that go. So what you mean is you want the people that are not going to go. She said, okay, that's a good point, and I accept that. So yes, I want them to go. I said, all right, that's fair. I said, why do you want them to go to the army? You want them to go because you want them specifically in the army, or you want them to just serve the community in some way? She said, well, I want them to serve the community in some way. I asked her, are you familiar with Magen David Adom, the first responders? She said, yes. I said, do you think there are any Haredim that work there? She said, yeah, for sure. I said, how many would you estimate? Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands? And what about Yichud Hatzalah? The entire organization is a Haredi organization. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of volunteers. And what about Yad Sara and Zaka and Ezer Mitzion and all of these organizations where Haredim, Orthodox Jews, are volunteering and serving the community, and they're not distinguishing between Orthodox and non-Orthodox, or even Jew and non-Jew. They are serving people because that's what they're doing. And they're not doing it for 3 years, they're doing it for their entire lives. What about doctors? Are they helping people? How many Orthodox doctors are there? How many Orthodox scientists are there? So when we say that they're not serving people, what do you mean by that exactly? She agreed to that point and admitted that it seems like the majority of the Haredi Orthodox Jewish population is indeed serving the community. And I argue that they all are in some way. Even people that serve, that have a local gemach, a local charity or some sort of organized help for the community, whether it's a gemach or a service which assists with children or children's materials, or for example, there's a medicine gemach in my neighborhood. If you ever need a medicine after hours when the pharmacy's closed, you can go there and you can get it for free even and just replace it the next day. There's a lot of gemachs, and these are just regular people, and they do this for the good of the community. And if you want to claim, well, that's serving the local community, that's not helping people in Tel Aviv. Well, if you had someone with a homeless shelter or a food kitchen in Seattle, would you complain that he's not running the same service in Chicago? No. You would say that the fact that he's serving Seattle is already a very big thing. So I think we have to recognize every single gemach that people organize, all of their charity organizations and efforts to serve each community. And that numbers in the hundreds of thousands. So she admitted that it seems like the Haredim, Orthodox Jews, are doing more than their fair share and more than anyone else when it comes to service and giving back. But she said, that's still not enough. My husband fought in the Yom Kippur War, and he put his life on the line. He was Moser Nefesh. And I said, oh, you don't think that any of these volunteers put their lives on the line? Whenever there's a rocket attack or there's a terrorist attack, who are the first people on the scene? It's always Haredim, whether it's Zaka or Yichud Hatzalah or Magen David Adom. Haredim, Orthodox Jews, are the first ones on the scene. So it's very difficult to say that they're not being Moser Nefesh and self-sacrificing. She said, but I would like all Haredim to be signed up for the army. I said, I'll tell you what, let's make a deal. I'll make sure all of the Haredim go into the army. And of course, just like the Haredim that are there now, they follow all the instructions in the army. They listen to their commanders. They follow all the laws and the rules of the army, and without exception. So on condition that I do that, I would like you to send all of the Chilonim, non-religious Jews, to yeshiva. You're requesting a 3-year commitment, so we are requesting a 3-year commitment. Every non-religious Israeli Jew will go to a seminary or a yeshiva, and they will commit to 3 years of full service without ever questioning the rabbi, without contradicting, following all the orders, following all the halachas, following all the 613 mitzvahs, following everything to a T. And this woman made a sour face and said, no, there's no chiloni, there's no secular Jew who would ever agree to that. And I said, so ma'am, it doesn't seem like you really care about equality and an equal burden and sharing the burden. It seems like you care more about coercion through the army. She looked at me with astonishment and said, you know, I really have to think a lot about what you said. She told me I should be a rabbi, and she told me that she's glad that we spoke. She agreed with me. She said she had to think about it, and she left the protest with her flag rolled up.
I mean, is there anything not to like there? People left the nicest comments on this video. Wow. This is powerful, a calm voice discussing instead of yelling. Powerful, we need to pass this along. This is so beautiful. There's so much derision, criticism, disrespect leveled at the Haredi community these days, and it is so refreshing to be reminded of the beauty and necessity of a community that holds so strongly onto the Torah values. Yes, we need our soldiers, and we need our Haredim. All are vital to the continuity of the Jewish people, and one day soon we will be zeicha to see how everyone fits and belongs in the picture. And dozens of positive comments, and then the negativity starts. Here's a different perspective. I served in the army, and I've been to protests. First of all, protests are a good thing. Haredim do protests all the time. I'm not saying not to protest. They let people voice their opinions. Second of all, most of the voices protesting right now, what you call left in Chilonim, including me, feel that the Haredi politicians are corrupt and have too much power. The result is painful to all of us and only getting worse, with 51% of Haredim in poverty, Haredi politicians pulling the country's purse strings with stipends and funding for schools that don't teach math and science, which will in turn cause more poverty. The army is just one of the painful reminders, pitiful because we all know people who have failed defending it, that corrupting Haredi leaders perpetuate this disparity with the power they wield in government and economy, all while telling their voters that the Haredi population is underrepresented and underserved, hoping we can fix this problem, blah, 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 blah. This is good. This is bullcrap. He starts off saying that they are out to fight Torah and mitzvahs, then goes on to talk about how he gaslighted a woman who had a serious concern demand that Haredim do their fair share and protect the country. All the organizations are very nice, but compare them to sending your family member in the line of fire, some never coming back home. This is exactly the problem. The establishment brainwashes you into thinking we are doing our part and even more. Come on. And if it's propaganda, and if it's religious propaganda, we don't deserve a little positivity. We don't deserve a little credit. We don't deserve a little positivity. I mean, what's the big deal? Can't you just leave something positive alone? This week's episode of The Weekly Squeeze has been brought to you by Mosaic Press Publishing. Mosaic Press is the premier Jewish book publisher dedicated to preserving and celebrating the rich tapestry of Jewish culture, history, and thought. With an extensive collection spanning fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and more, Mosaic Press brings you extraordinary works from both established and emerging authors. My favorite books are Whatever It Takes from Shia Hecht, Torah Leadership, 999 Fun Facts About the USA, and Reclaiming Dignity, which is practically sold out, so grab that. If you are looking for something to keep your kids busy with on Shabbos, order a copy of 39 Things You Can Do on Shabbos for Kids. That is a great title. We have it here. Mosaic Press books are beautifully bound with gorgeous covers designed to last a lifetime. So head over to my show notes, use the coupon code CHANALA20, and order some Jewish books today. You can never go wrong by adding Jewish books to your library. Mosaic Press books are known for being thoughtful and beautiful inside out and are available around the world. So head over to my show notes, get your 20% off, and pick up some Jewish books today. Whatever It Takes, The Choice to Believe, Living Tehillim. Mosaic Press has all the titles your entire family can enjoy. All right, two great interviews to get to. I don't have a show on Monday, so perhaps listen to half now, half on Monday, and that way you'll get your weekly squeeze fix right on schedule. I'll be back next week on Thursday. All right, my first guest is Caroline Bass. You might have heard the advertisement on episode 111 about Queen Tulsi calming herbs. Now, I'm into herbs and I'm into calm, so the combination, well, that's got to be a winner. I reached out to Caroline. I said, come on the podcast and share with us some of your calming aura and what exactly is in that bottle that makes you look and be so chill, because you are just the essence of relaxation. I get calm just going through your Instagram stories. And she's here to talk about the herbal supplement that she created, a female-owned business with a fabulous product that can help all the stressed-out moms and the husbands of the stressed-out moms. Well, just order Queen Tulsi for your wife. I mean, nothing says, I love you, stay calm, like a calming herbal supplement. So without further ado, Caroline Bass. Caroline Bass, welcome to the Weekly Squeeze. This is so exciting.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Yeah, I feel like we've connected on social media in like a very deep, intimate way almost. I don't know. There's something about you that I've gravitated to. And I'm thrilled to finally have the opportunity to have a conversation with you about what you do and who you are and how much you know. So let's jump right in.
Thank you. Yeah. I even invited you to my son's bar mitzvah. That's how close I feel to you.
Exactly. And I ain't come. I don't remember where. I think it was up north, right?
Yeah, it was in spots. It was hard to get
to. All right,
to.
Keep the invitations coming. Eventually, I'll be at one of your simchas, Emirat Hashem, or you by mine. All right, so you're the founder of Queen Tulsi Daily, a vitamin that I'm going to need you to convince me to take, because like everyone else, I'm not too lazy to swallow absolute junk, but for vitamins, you know, for some reason, it's a challenge. So I want to learn all about that. But first, tell me a little bit about your background growing up in New York City. Now you're on the West Coast, and how having an Israeli mom, an American dad, how that shaped your worldview.
Sure. So yeah, I'm from New York City, born and raised in Manhattan, real city kid. And my mom is very Israeli. Like until today, my kids are like, how is she still so Israeli? Like nothing has, she hasn't like integrated into the American society at all. But you know, Israelis sometimes just stay Israeli. And so I grew up with a lot of Hebrew in the house. So we speak Hebrew, and my dad is very American New Yorker. He was born in the Bronx and, you know, just like American Jew. His family immigrated from Poland, and my mother's family is from Egypt. So it's this Sephardic Ashkenaz mix in the house, which was always interesting and lively and fun.
I can imagine.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I grew up in kind of like this very hectic household because my mom is such a tough Israeli. And so there was a lot of chaos growing up. And so I think from a very young age, I really tried to give off like this calming energy in my house to kind of calm that chaos down. And I didn't really notice that I was doing this until later on in life, especially in college, where people used to say, you have such a calming energy. And I was like, I do. I don't really understand what you're talking about. But I started paying attention that whenever I'm in a place of chaos, which is kind of how I grew up with the, you know, the such a feisty household, I would try to settle that down, right, with like this calming energy. And so it's always just kind of been a part of who I am, like to gravitate towards a sense of like calm and balance.
It's so interesting to me because I totally get it. Like I live here in Israel. It's just a nature. It's really the way your mother is probably hardwired. It's not her fault, but look how the mother that God gave you ended up defining your life choices in so many ways. So I love that it's part of your story. So what motivated you first to become a doula? Because that's a big one. And how did you become interested in herbs and all their uses?
Sure. So I eventually left New York and I moved to Berkeley. And my dad was always very into health and wellness. I grew up as just part of a natural part of my life. And when I moved to Berkeley, I wanted to become, my dream was to be a midwife. And so I started working at San Francisco General Hospital, and I thought I was going to go down that road to be a midwife. Eventually, I ended up leaving that field, but I became a doula along the way with home birth midwives. And a big part of the learning and the teaching was to learn how to use herbs, especially for women who were prenatal and then during pregnancy and then postpartum. And I just loved it. I really saw that it made a big difference with these women with their prenatal care and then postpartum depression. And so when I saw the effect firsthand, I started incorporating it into my life. And sometimes we think herbs, oh, this big, crazy, scary thing, but really it's tea is a form of herbs. You can take a tea to help calm you down, and that will just help balance you. When we in Israel, there's so many spices and herbs. It's just part of daily life. Even parsley, right? Parsley is a great herb. Cilantro is a great herb. So we don't think about these herbs that we're using in our daily life as affecting us and helping our health, but they completely are. And so if you think of it as something that's just like natural that you gravitate towards, where you have it in your garden, then you won't be as afraid to use these herbs, like this classic.
Right. I had Sarah Hannah Radcliffe on my podcast. I'm sure you know who she is.
She's like a
master herbalist. She's delightful. And she taught me so much. And she really did introduce me to the concept that it could just slowly become part of your life. And it's not as intimidating as you might think. Listen, I started gardening and I never, ever thought that I could make anything grow. So, you know, once you lose that fear of, you know, the unknown, you can embrace it and incorporate it into your life. And it's really something important, especially in a world full of toxicities. I mean, is there anything you can buy in a store that doesn't have some sort of toxin in it? Not really. Okay. Not really. So I see how it goes hand in hand with midwifery and all that. But you took it so much further. I mean, you started your own herbal supplement line.
I never thought I would do that.
Tell us a little bit about that. It's crazy. I know. And it's the personality thing definitely played a role in it. But to actually take it and make it into fruition, what was that process? And then we'll talk a little bit about what sets Queen Tulsi apart from other products on the market. So how did you get into the vitamin production business?
You know, it's interesting. I never thought I would ever do anything like that. It wasn't even in my, you know, you have dreams of what you're going to do in your life. I never thought this would ever happen. So I have three children and they're wonderful children, but children become difficult at a certain age, especially when they reach teenagehood.
You don't say.
All different stages. So a few years ago, I had like a teenager in high school, a middle schooler, and an elementary school daughter, two boys and a girl. And they would come home from school. It's like this whirlwind. They drop their backpacks off. Where's dinner? They're hungry. They're cranky. They need their homework. And I'm like, it was like the second half of my day was starting and I was always overwhelmed.
Right. The blood pressure, your blood pressure goes up as soon as they walk through the door.
And like, no matter how much you feel you're prepared for it, it's just like they bring in all their energy from the day. And, you know, just a kind of a side note, whenever I volunteer in my children's class and I stay there for a few hours, I really appreciate what they go through, because it is hard to sit there from 8 to 3 every day or however long your hours are. It's exhausting. The teacher's on you. It's stressful. And so it just gives you a little bit of grace and understanding if you go and you actually volunteer in your children's classrooms to not yell at them the second they walk in through that door. Like, do your homework.
I love that. Yeah, because your kids have to decompress too. We want them to behave a certain way and we think, oh, school's easy. But it's draining on a kid. And sometimes they just need to come home and unload on you. So you need to be in the zone to accept all of that unpacking.
Exactly. Exactly. And to understand that sometimes, and they just need that hug. Sometimes they need that space. But it was having three children at such different stages in life. I felt so overwhelmed every day. And I didn't like the person I was becoming. I was always angry. I was stressed out and do your homework, get into the shower. It was just like this constant, you know, just snapping and sergeant and your homework's not done and go to bed. And I was worn out by the end of the day. I really couldn't.
And not liking yourself.
Right. And I didn't like, this is not the mother that I wanted to be. This is not the mother I needed to, that I imagined myself becoming. I never meditated. So I couldn't really tap into like a way to calm myself down with meditation, but I knew herbs. So I started mixing different herbs for myself. I knew the big herb that everyone knows about is ashwagandha. So I knew about ashwagandha and I was like, let me try this.
I don't
this.
Know about ashwagandha. What is that?
Okay.
It's no, amazing. I told you I know nothing.
Well, it's this
about that.
There's actually this Israeli guy. I have to find him for you. It's all in Hebrew, but you know, maybe you can share it with your listeners. He goes around Israel and he finds all of the different roots and herbs in Israel and he uses it. He blends it up in his apartment and he creates different tinctures for people. It's really amazing, but it's all
like a wizard.
Yeah, it's really wild. And so ashwagandha
is it the orange plant? Is it orange?
No, it's like a root. It's a dark.
Okay, because there's another orange plant. Oh, that's something you could smoke. Never mind. There's an orange plant that grows all over that you can smoke. Okay, different herb. All right,
This you don't smoke. It has a very strong smell. It's very potent and pungent. But it's been used in Ayurvedic medicine for centuries for many different reasons. It's anti-inflammatory. It helps with stress. It also helps with libido. So a lot of men would use this to boost their libido. It's the male essence of an herb, so to speak. So if you can think about like this kind of like this really intense herb, this root herb. And
powerful and potent.
Right, right. And it does help with stress relief, but I felt like I needed, I'm very in tune with my feminine side and my feminine energy, and I needed something to balance that a little bit, to soften the ashwagandha. And that's how I got introduced to this Tulsi plant. And so I would mix and match different plants and different herbs, and I found different supplements to help myself feel better. And I noticed a difference. And my husband noticed a difference. And he was like, what's different about you? Because it was also like these ups and downs with our hormonal cycles. Every month he's like, okay, I know what time of the month it is. I know what's happening. I can see it. And I hated when he said that. And I was like, I don't want to constantly be controlled by like these waves. And
like a slave to your hormones.
Right. And like you could see these waves coming and going and ebbing. And it was just exhausting. So when I found that I was able to find something for myself, I started talking about it on social media. And people said, what are you taking that would help you? So I said, buy this, 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 and this, these four or five herbs. And like you said, most people don't want to take different supplements. So now I'm telling them to take five different supplements. They were, Caroline, just give me something, one thing. And I was like, I guess you could, but nothing. One herb on its own will never work as well as herbs that are
combined. I think it's called stacking. Synergy. Is it called stacking?
It's stacking, yes, or synergy, yes, that you can stack herbs. And then though, because, and the reason why you can stack them is because they work in synergy. And so my husband one day said, why don't you just create your own supplements? And I said, I have no idea.
Like, where do you start?
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the supplement market that exists now, because most supplements are made in China and we don't know what's in them. And there's a lot of crap, a lot of junk in the ingredients. So is that something that you were concerned about and you did like research about?
Completely. This was right when COVID was starting. We didn't know what was happening. I just knew, I said, if I want to create a supplement, I really don't want anything coming from China. We went to different, where I live in Los Angeles, there's all these different manufacturing plants. We started touring the plants. And while I was touring the plants, I would notice these stacks of supplements with labels that I'm familiar with. And I said, oh, they produce them here. They manufacture them here. And they said, oh, no, everything is this. You choose whatever you want. You put your own label on it. I said, but how do I know exactly who's sourcing it? Where is it from? Is it kosher? Is it high quality? Is this really effective? And I swear they looked at me and they said, no one ever asks those questions. We know that these sell and you just put your label on it. Don't worry about it. And I did not want to go that route. But it also was very eye-opening to know that most of the supplements in the market are just simply, you walk into these manufacturing plants, you choose the formula that you want that's already been generated by some company in China, and you just put your label on it. And even some of the big influencers who have their own supplement brands, if you look at the ingredients in the back, the exact, you can sort of now start to see the patterns to understand that these are actually just private labels. They're just already created and they're just putting their label on it.
Wow. So how does one go about creating their own vitamin line? Like, I know with perfumes, you can go and smell all the flavors and put them all together. Is it something like that? Or is it a whole different experience?
So my husband got connected to this really incredible chemist who works with adaptogens in the United States.
What are adaptogens? I wanted to ask you that.
So adaptogens, think about adaptogens and the word adapt. They help you adapt to stress. It was actually created with Russians who wanted to try to increase their performance, Russian athletes, to try to find a way to tap into their performance levels and increase their performance levels. So the best way to think about what does it even mean to adapt to stress? Okay, this is a good analogy that I feel like really people get this. If it's cold outside and you walk outside with a t-shirt, you're going to feel cold and you're going to feel freezing. You need to adapt to the cold outside. So you put a jacket on and slowly that jacket warms you up. So that jacket is helping you adapt to the cold outside. And so that's what adaptogens do. It's not the same as a pharmaceutical that will actually maybe block
a nerve receptor or a message to your brain. Right.
Right. And it's not like CBD or THC, which will change the way your brain is functioning and processing information. It's actually helping you become more resilient so that when the stress is coming at you, you're not so reactive to that stress. All the kids are coming home, everyone's freaking out, everyone's stressed out, and you're just like in this calmer state because your body is not as responsive and reactive to the stress. You're able to actually calm yourself from within. And like a jacket that's keeping you warm, the adaptogens are keeping you calm.
Fantastic. So you said it's ashwagandha. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Ashwagandha. Right.
And Tulsi, which is your product, that's made up, I just did a little bit of research, of holy basil. So is that part of that family, the ashwagandha family?
No, it's not. It's not actually. So Tulsi is from the holy basil family. I actually have the plant outside. It's from India, and it's a very sacred holy plant in India. So it's called, my product's called Queen Tulsi, because Tulsi is known as the queen of all herbs. She's the mother elixir of life. Herbalists say if there's one herb that you will take for the rest of your life, it should be Tulsi, because it is such a soothing herb that helps with longevity, with inflammation, with stress, with bringing balance. It's really this supportive, balancing herb, and people take it in tea forms. It's very popular. So I have the Tulsi plant outside. I just water this plant, give it lots of sun, and then the leaves are perfect for tea. So I take off the leaves, I rinse them, and I just put some hot water on it. You don't want to put boiling water. You always put hot water on your tea. Another secret about tea is that you should always cover the lid of the tea. Sometimes people drink teas and they say, it's not really working for me. And it's because all the volatile oils are escaping. So you keep it closed, and then the tea itself will just absorb all of the nutrients. And so that way, right, it'll be more effective.
My husband's Sephardi, and they drink a lot of tea. It's like a thing, Israelis, you know.
Yes.
And we have this little samovar, this can or whatever it is, with a cover.
Yes.
And they seep the tea. And now, yes, I'm thinking about it, it's more effective when the tea has an opportunity to kind of sit and the herbs, like, you know, saturate, exactly, the water.
Exactly. So sometimes people will drink these teas that have all these great benefits, and they say, I don't really feel the benefits. Well, it's because it's all escaping and it's not infusing into the water.
So good to know. I hope all the tea drinkers are taking notes.
Yeah.
Duly,
yeah,
noted. Yeah. But let's go back to the production. So you want to produce this on a big scale so that people can buy it and benefit from it. I could only imagine that this is an expense and an investment.
Right.
So yeah. So tell us about how you got there.
So I met with this chemist who started putting together this formula. I said, I want it to be calming. I want it to make me feel less stressed out. And I wanted to help with my PMS. And I'm also in my 40s. So I was starting to experience perimenopausal symptoms. So I really needed to also do something with my hormonal imbalance every month. I just need to feel more balanced so that I don't have these ups and downs. I'm very big into skincare. So I said, can you also do something that will add a little bit of this boost for my skin? And stress causes inflammation in the body. So I said, I would love for you to also add some herbs in here that will help with inflammation in the body, because it's not just an emotional and mental stress that we're going through. It's also physical stress that affect inflammation of the body. And the root cause of nearly all disease is inflammation.
Oh, yeah.
And high cortisol levels will increase your inflammation. And so there's like this cycle that we go through. So he said, okay. So he created a batch for me, which with all of these herbs, I had 14 different herbs in there. We did a test run for a few weeks. I had other people try it. I didn't really feel much of a difference. We had amazing herbs in here. So then I learned the more herbs you have in a product, the less effective it's going to be, because you need to try to fit every single herb inside this little capsule. And so each herb is not as potent. So we started pulling some herbs out, even though I had some great mushrooms in there, like reishi and shaga and lion's mane, which are great for your brain and thinking and cognitive processing. We started removing them. We did another test run. So yes, all this is expense and money, but it was really important that I got this right. I didn't want to put something on the market where people said, I don't really feel anything. So we did another test run. I said, I still don't feel that much of a difference. Let's increase the two main herbs, ashwagandha and Tulsi, which work in perfect synergy together. So then he changed that dosage. We tried it again. And I had my test. I had a whole group of people working with me. And this time we all felt a difference. We all felt good. None of us had any upset stomach, no heartburn. Sometimes you can get that from too much potency in the herbs. We all felt calm and relaxed. I said, this is it. This is the formula.
And wow, so it's like that magic minute when it all came together.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. And then when I ran out of the test formula, this is also how I knew it was working. We all felt like we need this.
Crap.
Yeah, we felt a difference. That's whenever people are like, do I know? Is there a difference? I say, stop taking it for 2 weeks. Take it for 6 weeks and then stop for 2 weeks. Do you notice a difference? That's the best way to test.
Right.
If you notice a difference, then go
back. Can you take vitamins though? If you have like an awful diet, if you are overweight, if you drink, you want to have like a clean system when you ingest these vitamins. And not everybody has that, and they kind of feel like, what's the point? Like, my eating is not great, and I'm overweight, and, you know, what's a little vitamin going to make a difference? So do you recommend that people change their entire lifestyles or just add this to their diet, however their, you know, nutrition looks today?
Look, of course, it's ideal to work in many different areas of your life to try to change your life. There's no magic pill. Nothing is going to be magical. Even if you did meditation, but then you went to work and you were really angry, like, everything has to work in balance. And so this is just one of the tools. If you are trying to change your life, if you are overweight and going through hormonal changes and you really want to start making changes, you have to start small, otherwise it won't stick. And then whatever you're choosing, you do consistently. So kind of like you were talking about stacking, the same thing with stacking these habits. So you start with one small habit, and then you just keep adding until you start seeing that your whole life is changing in this slow but sustainable way where you can actually manage it.
Right. And also, when you take a vitamin in the morning, it's almost psychological. You're not going to like chug a milkshake because you're investing in yourself. Like, you're committing to your health on some level, and it kind of like mitzvah, like one mitzvah brings another. So one good, you know, action for yourself will lead you into another. It sounds like you're saying.
Exactly. And these are not even considered really vitamins. This is just more of a herbal support. And I don't even recommend taking it in the morning. This is more of an evening support, because it does help you unwind at night. When sometimes I feel like everyone is very focused on mornings and what should we do to have the best day ever. We start with our morning. And we've forgotten about our evenings. And especially for women and mothers, I think that evenings are a really difficult time for us. I tend to feel so worn down by the end of the day, and I lose my patience more quickly. I'm not as gentle and soft with my kids. I'm not as gentle and soft with myself. What did I do today? I'm very hard on myself. And so I use Queen Tulsi at night to help myself unwind, to calm down. I have my tea at night. So I've created these evening rituals to help bring balance to the end of my day. And I've noticed it made a big difference as well.
I love that. And also, when you go to sleep like a lion, when you go to sleep, I forgot the Pirkei Avos, but when you go to sleep like a mensch, you can wake up like a lion. So if your night wasn't chaotic, I suppose it'll affect how your morning begins.
Sure. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You want to have a good, restful sleep.
How do you approach educating people, you know, consumers, about the benefits and the proper usage of it? I see that you're posting on Instagram. Do you have it in stores? Is it mostly like from one-on-one clients? What is your experience now, 2 years later, that the vitamins are available and people have started using it? What's some of the feedback? Tell me how it's been.
So it's all been word of mouth, which is amazing. And I know I should invest in marketing. I haven't. And I'm just in awe of how much I've been able to create awareness just through word of mouth, which for me is the biggest compliment. I have so many women reach out to me saying, I just bought a package for my mother, for my sister, for my friend, for my neighbor. They want to share this with other people. And that's really how it's spread. I haven't really invested much. I also, until recently, I had a full-time job. And so I really just was kind of doing this on the side. And, letting it take off on its own organically, which it has. And I'm, thank God, Baruch Hashem, it's just been amazing in that regard. And now I'm just starting to look into different avenues. So I'll be going to a live event in Los Angeles in September, where I'll be presenting on stage with a panel of women and talking about Queen Tulsi there. So now I'm starting to look more into outside marketing and kind of sharing the wisdom. But so far, it's just been organic.
And you're here in the Weekly Squeeze. So that's pretty cool.
Exactly. Yes, I love it.
You know, I always describe it as, you know, parents are supposed to be like a rock in the ocean, and the waves crash against it. And no matter how fierce the waves are, the rock sits. And that's a parent. You know, the kids crash against us, but we're solid. So tell us a little bit about, I went through your Instagram posts earlier. You have so many great tips and advice. So you have a morning routine. What does that look like? You share sometimes your good morning and you're making your teas. How do you incorporate the herbal remedies in the morning if you do? And what does your morning look like?
It's very simple, because as a mom who still has two kids who are still at home who need my help, sometimes I look at these morning routines and I feel like, how do these women have time for this? Do they have kids at home? Like, I don't understand. What is their life like in the morning? So I'm going to give you an honest morning routine that actually works if you're busy and you still have a life with children at home. I wake up, I say Modani, I do a really quick stretch. I just raise my hands up, I bend down, especially as you get older. It's really important to try to stay flexible. So I just do a quick stretch in the morning. This is just right as I'm getting out of bed. Modani, a quick stretch. Then I start my day, I come downstairs. I drink 25 ounces of water with lemon and a pinch of Himalayan salt. Really simple. Just the first thing you should do when you wake up is rehydrate your body. When you sleep, you lose so much fluid and you become very dehydrated. It's the best thing you can do for your skin. And water is energy. When you feel depleted and tired, it's common to reach for coffee, which obviously will give you that jolt. But water is really energy. So if you do feel tired through the day, I recommend drinking water instead of having your coffee first. So first I have my 25 ounces of water I have here, lemon water.
Nice. And chug it through the day. Oh, it's 9:30 in the morning by you. Okay.
Yes, it's early nice. Here. And then I have my coffee. So always water before coffee. And then my son goes to my middle child goes to school first. And then I have exactly 8 minutes before I have to wake up my little one. And that's when I meditate. It sounds crazy. 8 minutes in the middle. But before I would just kind of sit there, maybe scroll on my phone. But now I just put on my timer for 8 minutes. I put on some Apple Music meditation music. And I literally just close my eyes and just breathe for 8 minutes. It makes such a big difference. You could think, how can 8 minutes? You're in a rush. First of all, you know what's funny about this? I'm exhausted in the morning when I wake up. And it gives me like another chance to close my eyes again. And I know that sounds funny, but I treasure just closing my eyes for those 8 minutes. Sometimes I have 10 minutes. So 8 to 10 minutes just helps me again feel more re-energized. And I was never a meditator, but I read this book called The Surrender Experiment. He talked about meditation. It's a really incredible, beautiful book. It's actually life-changing if anyone kind of needs some inspiration in their life if they feel stuck. And he talked about meditation and what it's done for him, just kind of like quieting your mind. And it's something that's important to think about meditation. I was like, oh, I can never meditate. I don't know how to stop my thoughts. It's not. It's like looking at the ocean saying, let me try to stop the waves. No, you're not trying to stop the waves, but if you're standing there aware that you're watching the waves, that's really what meditation is. It's just you kind of sitting in your space, aware that these thoughts are coming in, but you're noticing those thoughts as opposed to letting the thoughts getting spiraling out of control. And so,
right, which they tend to do.
They tend to do. And then it can take you to a dark place if you're hard on yourself, if you're speaking negatively about yourself. And so if you notice the patterns of these thoughts, like I have so much to do, I have da da da, what did I do? Then you'll notice, but if you start noticing that, then you can help kind of calm those waves that are going through your mind. So you're not trying to stop the ocean of the waves. You're just trying to notice that so that when something is coming at you and you are in a stressful situation, you can just kind of use that technique and stop for a minute and just say, okay, this is stressful and hectic. Let me just take a pause to see how I'm going to respond to this.
Wow. 8 minutes. That's something that most people can manage. Definitely. Even when, like you said, between waking up kids, I have kids who wake up at 7, wake up 7:15.
Right.
So just instead of wasting your time and kind of folding some laundry or whatever,
right,
make it your special time to just focus.
Exactly. And so then I do lunches and breakfast, whatever, I get everything ready. And then when I send my daughter after school, then I go for a quick walk, depending on how much time I have. I try to do 30 minutes a day also just to get sunshine. I don't wear sunglasses because it's really important to get those early morning sun rays. It also helps your cortisol levels and it helps just feeling that sense of peace. And I don't always listen to music or podcasts during, I'll listen maybe for 25 minutes, but the last 5 minutes, I think it's really important to take off your headphones and just be in the space around you. I feel like we're so constantly stimulated that we've forgotten how to just be in the space around us. And so the last 5 minutes, I'm just listening to the noises. I just look at the sky. I look at the trees. And just, they even say like the pattern of walking and seeing the landscape kind of unfold in front of you is very calming.
And when we're listening to things, we're affected. Like the music could put us in a certain mood. It can,
right,
you know, trigger a certain emotion, or a podcast could frustrate you, or something that you hear can like tick you off. So like, why do that to yourself? I noticed more and more actually, because I'm a podcast, audiobook, music junkie, that I'm appreciating silence. Because I do want to take in information all the time. Like I love to learn. But at the same time, right, I find myself a little bit on edge when I'm constantly accosted, right, by other opinions, other voices. So when I go out to, yes, garden, now that I'm a gardener, and it's quiet and I can hear the birds and I can focus in on the flowers, I feel like the world is my oyster and no one is telling me what to think or how to feel or how to be.
Exactly. Exactly. And like what you said, when you're constantly listening to other people's opinions and their voices and they're just, even if it's helpful knowledge, when we're constantly consuming and not creating, then we're also not living in our true alignment and purpose. Like, what does it mean to be holy? Hashem, God is the ultimate creator. And so to be like God, we need to also create. And we can't create if we're constantly consuming. And so we do need to create that space, whether we're thinking and then doing or acting or touching the earth and planting the garden, then that's our sense of creation. So now that's kind of living more in alignment of with our soul's purpose.
We don't even know what our opinions are anymore. Right. It's really hard to know. You think you are, maybe aligned with a political party, but then when you take the time to actually go through it and be true to who you are, you might be surprised. And also we can change and grow. We have to give ourselves space for that. And that's what those, exactly. Yeah, those quiet moments are for. There's some other things I wanted to talk to you about, specifically your approach to reversing gray hair. I know that gray hair is genetic, Baruch Hashem. I don't have any gray hair yet, and I would like to keep it that way. My hair has thinned, obviously, over the years because I cover it, but generally it does look pretty good still, and I'm grateful. So what is your advice for people who are graying too fast and they're looking in the mirror and they're just feeling like, it's over for me, I'm old?
Right. So this is an interesting one because I somehow found blackstrap molasses, which is like the most random, I don't even know what it is. It's just molasses.
It's a syrup.
So it's a syrup. But what it is, so blackstrap molasses is the third boiling of molasses. So you have the first boiling of the sugar cane, the second and the third, and it's all the minerals that are stuck after that boil that become very thick and like this viscous liquid. And so that's what turns into blackstrap molasses. So it's really just this syrup of minerals. I started taking it maybe 10 years ago because my hair was thinning so much. I had no hair, nothing. And I had like a thyroid condition, created by environmental things were happening in my area where I live. It was like this whole big natural disaster and it affected my thyroid. And so I was really desperate to grow my hair again. So blackstrap molasses helps with thinning hair. So I started taking it. And then I noticed that my hair was like very like rich and dark. And people would just comment on the color. How do I dye it? I said, I actually don't dye it.
Your hair looks great.
And I couldn't. Yeah, it was really amazing. And then I constantly took because I didn't want my hair to thin. So when I say by taking it, I take a tablespoon. So one tablespoon of blackstrap molasses has 25% iron, which is also good for your energy. And it helps with the thinning, but the copper is really what is the key component that helps with reversing and preventing gray hair.
And there's no side effects. There's nothing.
No side effects. And it doesn't affect blood sugar. I'm not exactly sure I'm not a nutritionist. I don't really understand how it doesn't affect blood sugar, but because it's really just a third boil. So there's the sugar content is actually much lower than you would think. And it has to be blackstrap molasses. It can't be regular molasses. And then after maybe 10 years of taking it, about a year ago, I think maybe in the pandemic, I stopped taking it for whatever reason. I was like, my hair is great. I don't need to take it anymore. And then I started graying.
Wow. I'm looking at you now. You don't dye your hair?
Well, now I did recently.
You have highlights, but I'm talking about the roots.
Right. There's no.
Gorgeous. There's no gray hair. That's phenomenal.
And it's dark.
Yeah. And you're 45, right?
Actually 40, turning 48.
Oh my God, you look amazing. Whatever you're doing is working, people. I promise you, whatever Caroline is taking, you need to be taking. She looks beautiful. Her hair is gorgeous. Your teeth are white. Your skin is shining. So yeah, you could sell it just by showing up and being beautiful. I love that. That's great. Black molasses. Okay. Is that something you can get on Amazon?
Blackstrap molasses. Yeah.
Blackstrap molasses. Okay. Excellent. Let's talk about Botox. Yes or no?
Whatever people want. I live in LA. Everyone does it. I've been doing facial massage every morning and I get very puffy and I wanted to do filler. I wanted to do the whole thing. I went, I got a consultation and I saw these people at me. I felt like I was like a clown, like in those clown shows where they're like, you know, their faces were all done and their lips and I was like, this isn't for me. And she was like pointing out all of my wrinkles here. And I was like, I actually think I like those wrinkles.
It's very interesting. People look great in their 40s when they do work on their face because that's like the perfect time. But then when you get to your like 50s and 60s, you look younger when you've had no work done.
It's true.
Right?
It's
like true. Works for a space of time. And people get carried away because you're 40 and you look great and your high cheekbones and everything's perfectly aligned and you look stunning and your lips are, you know. But then when you're 60 and 70, like it just doesn't come together. And it's almost like you said, you start looking like clownish.
Right. Yeah. And I've been doing a facial massage and I do notice a big difference. And then I know this is going to sound crazy, but I went to a Korean spa in LA and the women were all like smacking their face.
Tapping.
And I was like, what are they? More smacking. Okay. Tapping is different. Tapping is meditation. Okay.
So you're saying smacking your kids is not so bad. they'll thank you for it. Okay. No, just kidding. Yeah.
Don't quote me for it. No, I'm not. But no, so it increases the collagen in your skin. And so this little like lightly smacking, my daughter thinks I'm crazy when she sees me doing it in the morning, but I've noticed a difference. I feel like my skin just feels tighter and plumper. The pores, I have really large pores.
Well, a lot of people are using that rolling thing. It's like a jade roller. Is that kind of the same thing?
No, that's different. That's more for like lymphatic drainage, but I do it all with my fingers. I just love massage. I also, when I was a doula, I was trained in massage. And so I'm very into the power of touch. And so I do like upward massage. And then you want to always, whenever you massage, you want to make sure it all drains out of your lymph. And so you want to always clear these airways here.
Down your neck.
And not strong. The lymph is like kind of underneath the surface. You're not doing a deep massage. You're just releasing these channels here.
You're rubbing your neck. So you're rubbing the sides of your, okay. So you rub your face and then you go down to your neck, the sides towards the back.
Right. And then, because think of it as like drainage. So your face is all puffy and then you're just massaging it. So you come down from your eyes up here and then massage it out.
Right. And also that is relaxing. That is part of this experience of creating calm. One of my daughters has a tic that comes and goes. And there was a time we were trying all kinds of things, acupuncture and tapping and so on. And one of the things that they suggested was massage. And I was like, massage for a tic? Mm-hmm. Yes, massage. It releases all these endorphins and, you know, the power of touch. In general, I find that people who look great, it's not so much what they're ingesting, it's more what they're not ingesting. So tell us a little bit about, you know, you've mentioned on Instagram hemp milk versus almond milk. What are some common health foods that people are chugging that have no real health benefits and we should just stop already?
I think the big one these days is oat milk. I love it. It tastes delicious in my matcha, but it's really just
sugar
garbage. Yeah. So oat milk, I would stay away from. And then honestly, so I went from being a vegetarian for 25 years. My husband too, he's this big Israeli guy. We're both vegetarians. And then at a certain point in our life, it didn't work. And now we shifted to the other side, all animal protein.
Wow. Wow. Talk more about that. What are you talking about, keto or just more of like Atkins?
More almost like carnivore.
Wow. Where, I didn't expect that. Yeah. I thought you would be like a full-fledged vegetarian. So what shifted for you guys?
Our health was failing. Our skin was dull. It just started shifting in our body. It was like too many grains, too much. Everyone loves lentils and beans and we were living on rice and beans and it was just making us sick. My stomach, I couldn't, people are always talking about bloating. And I'm like, it's really related to your food. I don't bloat anymore.
Wow.
And ever since I shifted my diet, and this isn't for everyone, has to shift, work with their, I don't think there's one diet that
fits all. You have to know yourself.
Yeah. So we've just completely shifted to animal protein, lost so much weight and feels so much better, much more energy. I don't have eczema. My husband also used to have eczema on his arms. It's all gone.
Wow. That's wild. I mean, I'm sure you try to get organic grass-fed. Is that something you recommend?
Yes. Yeah. If you can, it's so expensive and everything is, I don't know what it's like in Israel now, but here I feel like everything is completely doubled. But Trader Joe's here has good, you can get organic. I'm pretty sure it's organic kosher chicken at Trader Joe's. I think it's organic or it's free range. And so,
and also protein in general keeps you fuller longer. So even though meat and chicken are more expensive than greens, you might need to use less of it. Like you have your eggs in the morning and your, you know, grilled chicken salad and a piece of meat in the evening, and you don't have to make big pots of lentils and breads and all these different things.
Exactly.
But the proof is in the pudding, because like I said, you look great and you feel great. So what more evidence do you need that this lifestyle is working?
Exactly. And you know, there was a point where I was like afraid to share that online, but I was like, what am I afraid of the other people's opinions? I know how I feel. I think that's the problem with social media. We see what these people are eating. Oh, we have to eat that way. Otherwise they're going to judge us or whatever. How do you feel? Do you feel good? Is your health okay? Is your blood work good? Is, you know, your weight in a healthy range? So then just keep going. You don't need to listen to all these outside sources. We need to be more in tune with our inner bodies and how we feel.
So tell us a little bit about how we approach losing weight after the age of 45. There are so many different ways, I know. But from your experience, what are some things that women over 45 can introduce into their lifestyle so that the weight comes off even slowly? Like I tell my husband, you don't need to lose 30 pounds. Lose 5 pounds a year instead of gaining 5 pounds a year and you're good to go.
Right. I think it really comes down to the animal protein. And what happens is as women, we're programmed to eat big salads and then we're starving afterwards. And then we're noshing and we're eating this, eating that. And feeling, if you have a big piece of salmon, and if you like your vegetables, have your vegetables. I just have salmon without vegetables anymore. Big piece of salmon. You'll have some water. Create that sense of fullness if you need that. But the salmon itself should keep you filled. Or grilled chicken, and it doesn't have to be such a small piece. It doesn't have to be this 2 ounce chicken. You can have 4 ounces of chicken. You have 5 ounces of chicken. You'll feel more full. You won't be snacking. You really should not be snacking throughout the day. I've found that that's. Means that you're not eating enough for lunch or for breakfast, or if you also are snacking after dinner, something is lacking. So it's usually the protein and then an added fat.
Well, I want people to experience your vitamin. So you offered a coupon code. I'm going to share that in the show notes. I could tell you that your calmness comes through even across the world. I mean, you're in California, I'm in Israel, and I'm already calmer just sitting here and talking to you. So first question, how am I getting a bottle? When are you coming to Israel next? And this time we're going to meet so I can get one of those Queen Tulsis. I'll order one. The truth is my husband's going to America, so he can bring me one back. So I'm going to start taking it too. So if this podcast starts to become really slow, we'll know that I'm taking Queen Tulsi and I'm in the zone. But you said to take it in the evening and I record my podcast in the morning. Okay, fine. So I'm going to give people a link that they can order it. And you ship it right to their house? You ship it from your house? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, no, we have like a little warehouse, and so they'll get it. We're trying to get on Amazon. Amazon's giving me a hard time. If you have any listeners who have connections with Amazon, because I have a trademark and they're saying I don't have a trademark on my product, but it is trademarked. I do recommend, just because it's based on all the studies, that you take it for 3 months to really feel the full effect. All studies on herbs and supplements are always done after 3 months. So you do need to look at 12 weeks. One bottle will last for 30 days, but you can up the doses. We created it so that you can take between 2 to 4 pills a day, depending on your stress levels. Many days I take 4 a day, depending on what I need, especially if I'm PMSing. I recommend taking 4 that week before you get your period to really notice a difference. You won't have PMS anymore. That's been a huge change that people are just love, that you no longer experience PMS. It's amazing. I don't think that women should suffer from PMS.
I love that it's called Queen Tulsi, because at the end of the day, when you are calm and when you can run your home in a pleasant way, you will be the queen of the home. Yes. And your husband will appreciate coming home, and your kids will want to be next to you, and they'll gravitate, you know, towards your aura. Amen. So the Queen Tulsi will make you a queen in your home. Yeah, I highly recommend it, just from knowing you and hearing all about it. So thank you so much for being here, Caroline.
Thank you.
And God willing, we should meet here in Israel in health, wealth, happiness, and only simchas.
Amen, amen. Thank you so much. I love this. This was great.
All right. My next guest is Leo from the Jew Function podcast, a terrific show. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. If your passion is anti-Semitism, like mine is, check out the Jew Function. He talks to all kinds of people around the world on the topic of Jew hatred and how it affects them personally. I was on the show. I rambled for an hour and a half about how I'm going to fix anti-Semitism. But alas, here we are a few months later, and it's alive and flourishing. So my question is, can ChatGPT, can artificial intelligence help us change the world? Is it possible? Is it possible that we can merge our ancient texts and find clarity on intricate Jewish laws? Can we receive spiritual guidance or have intellectual debates on religious matters? All of this keeping in mind that while AI holds great promise, it also raises important questions and challenges within our communities. Jewish law is a living, evolving system. It's shaped by generations of human interpretation and debate. Can we balance the insights offered by artificial intelligence with the essential role of human wisdom and intuition? I've been playing cat and mouse with Leo for weeks now. I finally have him on the podcast, and over a cup of coffee, we just had a freestyle conversation, and it was super interesting. So without further ado, Leo from the Jew Function. Leo, welcome to the Weekly Squeeze. Good morning. Tell the people what time it is.
It is 6:30 a.m. in Israel.
A beautiful time to be awake and a beautiful place to be awake. It's true. All right. We are going to dive into a super interesting topic of artificial intelligence and, of course, how it relates to Torah. I don't know about you, but technology is a big part of my life. Too big, sometimes, I think. So let's explore. Let's explore how AI fits into the Jewish teachings, ethics, laws. There are some really mind-boggling questions. And I think a lot of my audience doesn't even understand how ChatGPT even works. So, yeah.
This full disclaimer, I'm not an AI engineer. You know, I have a decent grasp on how it works. And more importantly, I hope I have spent some time trying to interact with the machine, which is an even more important aspect because it's a tachlis, right? I mean, knowing how it works is one. We don't know how the brain actually works.
That's a good point.
We don't know a lot of things about how we operate inside of ourselves and between us. And yet it doesn't stop us from doing things.
Totally.
So
I've listened to a number of explanations and podcasts on the topic. And honestly, I don't understand it all that much better. I just want to know how I could use it.
It's okay. Even AI scientists themselves admit there's a black box, inside. So they created the algorithms. They said, well, make a calculation, arrive at a result in this way. If you do it enough times, if you train yourself on certain models, then the answer you come up with will be a very good approximation of a certain truth. Okay, not cosmic truth or objective truth, but a truth based on the models we trained you on. And so, you know, that's how the machines were trained to identify numbers and letters.
But Torah is a whole different ballgame because Torah is the ultimate truth.
Well, that's a big issue. I mean, even without getting into Torah being like, you know, the word of God, just enough to acknowledge that the Torah and all the, you know, all this, you know, this material really comes from a sort of a level above. Okay, it's not man-made. And that's kind of where it starts. Obviously, it didn't come from aliens. It came through people, through humans who lived here, but it wasn't created by an egoistic human to serve egoistic needs. Despite a lot of misunderstandings that got associated with the Bible, the Torah over the years, and all the other egoistic stuff that, you know, ensued, it has a deeper meaning, an inner meaning that most people, sadly, even Jews themselves, don't recognize. And the big difference between that body of text and everything else that exists is that it was written with a different intention and towards a different goal. And so artificial intelligence was created by people, by humans, meaning you take an egoistic creature and you entrust it with creating something, it will create an egoistic little baby, right? And you can see it. You can see it on how they train these machines. You know, for example, in Amazon, they wanted to automate the process of hiring people. They said, okay, train on all these resumes of people we hired and help us hire more people. So within moments, the machine became biased towards hiring only men. Why? Because most people that were hired were men historically. And so it learned that if in the resume it says woman, women, part of a women's sport, women club, automatically it rejected these candidates. So it'll just be an amplifier, an amplification of our own shortcomings and our own egoistic view of the world.
That's very well explained. It's just a reflection of humans and human nature. And I think there was a lot of pushback the first few versions of ChatGPT when people were asking questions like, tell us some fun things about Trump. And it would spit out, you know, Trump is a masochistic, blah, 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 whatever. Yeah. Male chauvinist, blah. You know, tell us something nice about Obama, and it would sing its praises. And people were like, is somebody actually sitting there in their studio and replying? And like, that's not actually the case, but it's regenerating all this information. It's being fed, and it's being fed information that's slanted. First of all, because the internet at this point is heavily filtered. I mean, depending where you live, it's searching all these resources that are slanted. So that's the result. But let's talk about specific cases so people understand that even if they've never used ChatGPT or have no intention to, how it's going to affect their life. Because it's going to be part of all of our lives, in for good and for bad. So I pulled up a couple of things that, why are you laughing? You're like, for very bad.
Well, you know, again, a funny thing is people tend to think that the outcome of using the artificial intelligence, and some people have been promoting this view, is that the outcome of using it is that at one point the machine is going to become independent and going to start to say no to us humans who created it, right? And going to rise against its maker, and we have
man
the
against
rise
machine.
Of the machines. Right, exactly. The Rise of the Machines, Terminator, and it's going to be super smart and way more intelligent and devious than we can even think.
But it's not just robots. We're talking about...
No. I know. I'm just saying, I'm making a general assessment as to how people think of the threat. But the threat, and there's a few really good talks about it, including the father of godfather of artificial intelligence, and some good TED Talks, the threat lies mostly in just we don't understand the cognitive structure of artificial intelligence, again, including the people who made it. And so we don't really know how to ask it to do what we want it to do. And there's a greater danger of the machine simply doing what we asked it to do, doing it so well that it destroys us, right? Like, hey, get rid of cancer. So the machine goes like, all right, I'll just get rid of people and then there'll be no more cancer, right? So mission accomplished.
That's actually a great example. Well, the godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton, I suppose that's who you were talking about, I saw, and it was rather alarming, he quit Google and he warned that, he warned about the dangers of misinformation. He says that the chatbots were, based on his experience, they can be exploited by bad actors. And I'm on Twitter, and there are people on Twitter who are not even real people. I mean, you can look like a person, sound like a person, tweet like a person, and not even exist. And there's really no way to tell the difference.
Hey, there are people who are not real people. Come on.
Some You're saying are just, even when they're alive, even when they're not
alive,
a robot.
Yes, they're just, I mean, in fact, actually, you said that the machine is a reflection of us, and it's true on many ways, on a deeper level, way deeper than we think. Because we ourselves, we like to think of ourselves as autonomous agents, right? I know, I have me, I have my...
Moach Shalit Alalev.
Exactly. I'm in charge. And even if you remove take the creator out of the picture for a second, because you could say, well, it's all the creator and I have nothing to do with it. That's also, not a healthy approach. So let's just put it aside for a second. Just even if it was just us humans running around doing our stuff on the planet, the way we're wired by nature is to be products of our environment. So we are so influenced by everything that surrounds us, from your first moment that you're in your mother's belly, all the way till you start to display some seemingly
cognitive,
independent cognitive right processes and emotions. They've already been so carefully molded, consciously and unconsciously,
by your environment and by the people.
The environment around you. You are a 100% product of that environment. And the machines are also that. So to walk around pretending that you have this agency.
Autonomy and independence.
It's a necessary illusion, right? It's like time. You can say, well, time doesn't exist. Yeah, right. It doesn't exist. But for you, it exists. So stop acting as if it's not. It's a necessary illusion. That free choice is a necessary illusion. The question is, to what end?
Well, humans only use a part of their brains. I mean, isn't there like a statistic that we use a tiny part of our brains? The machines are unlimited and we're like practically lazy to think, thanks to Netflix.
I'll say two things about that. The first thing is that this, that people used to walk around thinking, oh, I'm only using 8% of my brain, and that's what we were told. It's not exactly true. It's more accurate to say that we don't know how the brain is being used. That's a more accurate assessment. Just like in the beginning of the DNA research, they were saying, well, there's 10% of the DNA is what's happening. There's 90% is junk DNA. They called it junk DNA, okay? They took billions of years of evolution and reduced it to, this is junk DNA. And now they're thinking, oh, well, maybe it's not junk. Maybe it's used for other purposes that we are not aware of. And they're starting to learn what it's doing, right? The whole DNA is acting like transmitters, and it's vibrating, doing all kinds of things. And the brain is the same thing. The brain, the misconception about the brain is that the brain is actually doing any sort of serious thinking. And it's not the case. The brain is a router. Okay. We live in a field of information, and the brain is the connection to that field of information. And that field of information is made up of every human alive, every bit of data that's out there in the ether, and probably every bit of energy that's ever existed. It's all making this one huge field of information.
So we're just the processors?
Well, no. The brain is a router, but the problem is the brain, the router, started making its own decisions. Right? It's like the secretary that was supposed to be like, hey, you have incoming mail. And it's like, at some point, it's like, I'm not going to transfer it. I'm going to reply to that mail myself. You know, I know what they're going to say. I'm just going to. So the secretary is starting to take over the operations. There is no autonomous thinking, feeling creature behind that's actually managing it. That's what's happening. And what I'm saying, and I'm not the only one saying it, it's not my own theory, is basically when humans learn to actually connect with each other. And this actually is a good connection back to the Torah and all those other elements. What are they for? What's the goal behind all those things, right? Which we can go to and talk about it later. But when we learn how to connect with others, when we open those channels, when we stop living life in this inward, one-sided, limited way of life, right? I live like a node, like a point at the end of a huge funnel. There's so much I can get, right? But if I can reverse the order, if I can start to live not in that, in the stimulation that I get inside of me, but in actually in those channels, in those pipes that come out of me to everyone else, that dimension is practically limitless.
Well, I was just going to say, so you're implying that human being, the capacity, our capacity is unlimited. I mean, that's
unlimited. We have no clue. We haven't even began to use what we, you know, what we're capable of doing.
So the machines have nothing on us?
No. The machine is so limited in so many ways. Yes, it can order a lot of plane tickets very quickly. It can launch nuclear weapons. It can improve, you know, its calculating ability. But people are way more than calculating machines. Okay, that's a very important distinction. As I said initially, the machine doesn't have an intention, or rather, it has the intention that humans gave it, which is an egoistic intention. Okay, I receive pleasure for myself in order to fulfill myself. It's right. It's this.
It's like when somebody says, "I like fish," when they're eating fish. Well, if you liked fish, you'd let the fish swim.
That's a classic example, right? That's one classic example. And that's true. You simply love the pleasure that they give you. You don't actually love them. And the same thing with relationship, right? I love this person. Why? Because it makes me feel good. Right. It makes me feel good.
Conditional.
It makes me feel great about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not the only place that's close to that. Close. It's not real. And it's because it's imposed on you by nature. You didn't actually earn it, right? But it's with relationship towards children, especially mother to a baby. That's the only place when you begin to feel the potential of feeling life outside of yourself, in someone else, deriving pleasure from fulfilling your baby's desires. When your baby, right, you give it food and he eats, you're filled with this, you know.
I always say the angels start singing.
The angels start singing, right? The Queen of England has a servants doing everything, but feeding her baby, she wants to do it because it's a pleasure that you cannot compare it. Now take that and imagine that you're able to reach a state where you can feel that pleasure relative to every human alive, derive that kind of pleasure from bestowing, from giving to other people, just like you give to your own baby, and you start to see, oh my God, it's like, whoa, I'm chasing this, you know, food, money, honor, a little power, my little box, this nothing. If you change the direction, right. Limitless.
I love that. Okay. I think the issue, though, is that, like, we're having trouble distinguishing computer intelligence and human intelligence. Mm. And that's because essentially people are susceptible to being easily fooled. And I think that's where the challenge comes in. What I want people to understand is that AI is a tool that they can use to make their life easier. It's not going to replace humans, although some people are suggesting otherwise. But as far as Yiddishkeit goes, as far as Judaism goes, okay, so I looked into this a little bit. Obviously, when it comes to medicine, diagnosis, making predictions, analyzing, I mean, the list goes on and on, what the computers can do to make people's lives easier. There's brain-computer interfaces that have been being used already for years. When you interact with your eyes and the computer communicates with you, self-driving cars, obviously robots, smart homes, like these are all the places where people are going to be interacting with artificial intelligence.
Maybe even more. I mean, the assessment is that between, and that's a funny assessment, but anywhere between 5 and 500 years from now, that's basically the range is very wide. Yeah, it's very wide because they don't know. They don't know. But we are going to look at a general purpose AI, one that can just be omnipresent and you can communicate to it, you know, even just with your thoughts. And it
well,
can
people
immediately...
said that about Alexa and Siri, but I don't feel that.
They're very limited. We're used to, that's why I distinguished general purpose from specific, right, a chat GPT or a chess machine or a Siri or Alexa. Those were all designed and trained on certain models to solve certain use cases, certain problems, right? Alexa is great when you stick it in a home or in a car or on your phone or, you know, Siri, and you tell it and you interact with it in ways that people expect people to interact with it. When you leave the realm of the training, you get into this, you know, this twilight zone where things are like, it's not exactly, but general purpose AI, when that arrives, that, you know, connected to the internet, connected to your stream of thinking, or even just to your voice commands, you know, to keep things simple, you can really pretty much accomplish anything. The question is, again, what would you like to accomplish? I met years ago, I co-produced a movie, it's called Crossroads. Not to be confused with the Britney Spears hit Crossroads.
It wasn't a hit, but okay.
It was a documentary on kind of the state of society. You know, it came out in 2012. You can watch it online, crossroadsfilm.com. It has a lot of really good ideas because it talks about the influence of the environment and all those things. And then when I was going around just kind of showing it, I met this guy, this Italian, really young guy who wrote a book. It's called Robots Will Steal Your Jobs, but That's Okay. And that was in 2012, right? And he talked about this shift that's coming and how robots will be able to replace people in many, many, many activities, right? Both mechanical, cognitive, otherwise. But what he doesn't talk about, or where he doesn't have like a really good answer, and that's where most people, I feel, fall short, is, all right, robots will steal your job and will do a lot of other stuff, other things for you. What are you going to do with your time? What are you going to be doing with it? I think it's very narrow, nearsighted to say, well, how can I use ChatGPT to just get, you know, more clients satisfied in my business and generate web pages without working? Yes, we can talk about it. If you want to ask, we can talk about all those little menial tasks that it can accomplish for you. My big question is, you know, look a step further into the future, the near future. What are you going to do with all this time?
Oh, you're saying... If it serves no real purpose and doesn't benefit our life in a substantial
let's say it benefits our life. Let's say it frees
nothing
up even
frees
more
up more time. My cell phone has taken my entire life away. I had more time. I'm serious. I don't think technology frees up time. I think as things get more simplified, we end up spending more time with the because we have so much potential. There's so much capacity. Like every time a new option comes out, I want to upgrade my whole life.
You know, ask some people. They'll tell you that things were much better
when I had
years ago.
Yeah, when I had a word processor.
Well, no, but even before that, you're just connected to nature, right? You're living according to nature's cycles. You're more in tune with nature. You have less external stimulation. You know, they found recent archaeological finds of tribes that lived in, I think it was the Amazon and a few other, Africa. They found evidence that they spent a lot of time doing nothing.
Psychopaths.
It wasn't like this constant run. Yeah, run, chase, do, you know, get. It was more like, okay, we got the food on the table. We can eat, we can celebrate, we can relax.
But the Jewish life has never been like that. I mean, we have an order of the day from the second we wake up till we go to sleep. Every single minute has to be accounted for. Exactly.
I
and you
agree.
Have to be participating in this Torah life and doing a lot of work.
I agree, because Jews have a different purpose. and by extension, humanity, which is a whole other little side conversation. If you want to jump into it,
I want to talk about it doesn't matter to me what the whole world is doing doesn't matter. The whole world thinks that the Palestinians are victims, so that doesn't affect me. I want to explain to people because again, you made a very good point. It all comes full circle when we can understand how it applies to a Torah life. So let's share with people how AI can help us perform some mitzvahs and in what areas you feel like they're... Why are you laughing? It's not going to... It can't. I'll tell you this much. You still have to go to Minyan today because it cannot replace you in a Minyan.
No, I looked that up. You in a Minyan.
No, but there are some things... there are some incredible things that it could do. And I don't think people are aware of that. Can I just share with you some things? And then
you can just riff off
of that? Okay. Yeah. First of all, you can teach a robot to remove the gidanasha, the blood vessels that we're not allowed to eat, the sciatic nerve. Yeah, that wouldn't be a problem. You could also use a robot to check for shotness. That's pretty impressive. You don't need kavanas to check for shotness. You just have to technically get it done. You can't use AI for shchita, but you can use a computer to check the sharpness of the knife, right? A laser can check the sharpness of the knife, even better than a human being, perhaps, right? If a robot could be programmed to learn what's important in a kosher kitchen, like not mixing meat and milk, could you have robotic mashgichim? I mean, think about it.
Why not?
Why not? That's the question. Why not? Because we really, there's no room for error when it comes to keeping halacha. I mean, think about, they're still talking about whether a Shabbos elevator is appropriate, you know, al pi halacha. Like, we're still discussing these little things that you might assume are no-brainers, but it's not. The Torah is really, really particular on how we keep its laws. So when you throw in all this stuff, it's a big, big challenge, I think, for halachic rabbanim to kind of figure out how AI can be incorporated into the from world.
I think it's important to say, people probably listening, not watching, that I'm not a from Jew, and I'm not a Hasidic Jew, an Orthodox Jew. I'm not
yet.
Okay. There's hope for me, hope for myself. I have a slightly different view on this, and again, it's not my view. I don't. It's not like I'm so smart or anything. But I, you know, I do try to study to learn from people who are great, and we do have great sages in the Jewish world, stretching all the way back to Abraham. Probably one of the only group of people who have this unbroken lineage of mm-hmm. of sages, of people who delved into the deepest meaning of everything, and why and what and what for, and all those big questions. I think, again, it goes back to the purpose and the meaning of it all. And this is the place where, you know, I don't want to challenge people's beliefs and habits. And I think if someone is happy where they are and doing what they do, they should do it. For me, you know, I was asking kind of the question of like, okay, what is the purpose of all those things that we're asked to do as Jews? What is the purpose of our very existence? You know, why take this one group of people and which was not a biological group? It's not like we took one, you know, no, it's like, when Abraham started, it was, you know, he took like representatives of all the different clans and small nations that lived there in Babylon and assembled them together around an idea. So we're clearly not the same as everyone else. You know, just our origin story is different, and how we evolved as a group, as a nation.
Even how we were created. I mean, God blew his essence into man. And that is really what makes a difference between a golem, a computer, and a human being. It's the nefesh, it's the neshama, it's the soul.
Right, right. Even that depiction, yeah. And again, I'm not personally subscribing to the literal meaning of those things. Rather, I'm trying to search the inner meaning of those things, okay, for me. So even looking at the inner meaning of all those things that were written, you can see that there's a different trajectory here, and it's not as simple as saying, well, we have a slightly different way of life, and we believe in slightly different things, and that's it. You know, everybody has their own beliefs and all that. No, it's not as simple as that. It's not like, oh, we have you know, we have Rosh Hashanah and Passover, and they have, you know, Christmas and whatever. It's not that. Because I think as people evolve, more people, the more we evolve and we grow and we add the machines into our lives, it makes us question our very existence here. And also the things that we believe to be true and how we arrived at those beliefs and why were there, were they there in the first place? Why did humans need to have this thing? Couldn't we just be, you know, happy monkeys? Why go through the trouble of becoming a human and going through all the trouble of chasing stuff and pursuing
trouble. What sets a human apart from a monkey is the capacity to speak. You know, humans are called a medaber, right?
Why did we need to speak?
Because we have free will. And when we speak, we can use that free will to make choices. If we don't speak, a dog doesn't have free will. It's on a leash. It doesn't communicate. I mean, it communicates through barks. But otherwise, you're pulling it along and it's doing what you want it to. But when you have free will, you could express what you're thinking and be like, I want to do it this way.
I like the dog example. I think the difference between the potential difference between human and animals, and I say potential because most of us we're not humans yet, you could say. We're like on the way to becoming. You know, in Hebrew, you call something based on what it's going to become, right? You name it based on its end purpose. We have the potential to become human, Adam, right? Adam from the word dome, similar to the creator that created us. In other words, animals, a dog that you said will just chase the bone, right? There's a little bone on a string and just chase the bone. A human will ask, wait a second, who's pulling that string on the bone? I want to know the hand that pulls the bone. I want to get in touch with that. That's the only difference between humans, potential humans, and animals. The desire that does not exist in animals to know, right, what's beyond, what's behind, who's behind, why all of this exists. You know, the more you look into creation and reality, scientists, they look into it, they say, well, there's something going on. We can't explain it, but there's something. There's clearly some unexplained order, things that we cannot explain, because let's not chalk it off just to randomness. Even if it were randomness, it's slightly weird because there are equal chances for the universe to not exist as they do to exist. It's like there's something. But for scientists, it's hard. They can't reject, everything they kind of were raised on and go into the why questions. They settle for what and how. But again, a human will ask why. And I think all of us, whether you're a religious person or not, at some point, and we see today more and more, people are asking this question, meaning the framework that was given to us. Whether you're totally secular, whether you're totally religious, whether you're somewhere in between, those frameworks were given to us just so we can have a life in this world. We can survive, we can thrive, I can feel okay with myself. I cannot, I won't lose my mind, right? There was either a reason or believe in this, and I'm happy. I can live this way. But we're coming to a point in human development where just because I said so is not enough. More and more people are actually beginning to discover that agency you're talking about. And that agency is not just to, hey, work within these frameworks to do whatever you want. Rather, I have a desire to find out what's happening. What's the meaning of this? Why do I do what I do for 70 years and then it's over? What's happening here? And so all of that, I think both the what we term as religious, and all the stuff that we term non-religious, the logical and rational, they're all simply different ways of looking at that particular issue.
Okay, Let me break in for a second. Rabbi Shalom Daver of Lubavitch, one of the Lubavitch rebbes, one of the seven rebbes, he said that human beings are taka midaber, but it's not just that we have the ability to talk, we have koach hadibor. Right. So what's the koach? He explains that human speech is different than any other type of communication because, you know, a parrot can repeat what you say. You ever went to a zoo and see chimpanzees? Like sometimes they seem so human, right, that it's hard to believe that they're not a minute away from writing a book.
We are 99%, share the same, genome, right?
Right. But medaber is more than that.
It is.
We we're giving shape to the letters and the words and the thoughts of our brains, right? And that is that's completely rooted in our souls, because without a soul, we don't have the capacity to express thought and language. You know, even the Hebrew language, it's not just kelev, it's kulo lev. The words themselves sustain the dog. The Hebrew words continue to give life, ongoing life, to the animal. So words are extremely powerful, especially Jewish words, Hebrew words that are coming from the human soul. So even though we characterize humans as medaber, those who talk, we're essentially characterizing them as having souls. And that's something that AI can't replicate. So I just want to point that out, that the capacity to speak is the capacity to express your soul. And that's what I think that my audience can appreciate.
No, it is a beautiful image. And, you know, we talk about, you know, thought, speech, and action as being this, right, this expression of your humanity that no other animal possesses. And it's true. But again, the question is, to what end? To what end? What is the purpose of all this? What is the purpose of these faculties that you were given, those capacities? Wouldn't you
To serve God.
Oh, so what is the will of God? You know, what does God want with
We know what God wants. The question is, if AI steps in to replace what humans are doing, the AI is not getting a reward in the world to come. At the same time, can you say, well, I created the software making my smart home, you know, Shabbos stick, and it's whatever the case is, whatever it's actually accomplishing. So can you get the reward for something that you created that you're essentially removed from at this point? You
know,
can a person who creates a robotic mashkiach be considered a mashkiach? Can a doctor who is using AI for questions, halachic questions, perhaps, it gets a little dicey. So the question is where the human starts and where AI starts and where it all begins and where it all ends. It's very hazy at this point.
It is hazy, and it will become more hazy. That's the good news. And it will become more hazy in order, again, to help us find the unique point. Meaning, the purpose of a human is not simply to follow a set of rules, of directions. Okay, you can. I know you're shaking your head, and that's okay. That's not your purpose. Okay, let's put it this way.
Mindlessly, you're saying.
Exactly. If those rules have a higher purpose for you, if they help you achieve something more exalted, that's a different story altogether. And that's where the intention comes into play. And that's you know, where the whole inner workings of a person come into play, and our ability to relate to other people. We keep thinking of ourselves as these individual units. I will do something. I will get a reward. This is the thought of a five-year-old, okay? And I think it's time we as humans, we rose from that level. We do behave as five-year-olds. I mean, this is not an indictment of certain people versus most people, most countries, most everyone in the world behave like little kids. Oh, this is mine. You took it. I'm going to take it from you. We're going to go to war. He did this. Please bomb him. Juvenile, right? This is my stuff, and I want it. And we need to start through. Even bacteria has been able to rise above that stage. And even mold has reached a stage where, from individual cells competing for resources, they started to form a superorganism. Imagine what would happen if humans would be able to form a superorganism. What would they feel then? What would they perceive then? Some would say they would be able to perceive the creator that created them.
First of all, we are partners in creation when we have children. That's number one. Number two, created COVID. What about COVID?
Yes, as a woman, you're doing all the heavy lifting, but we're not really partners. Come on.
Mapitom. Blasphemy. I'm sorry. What do you mean? Husband and wife and God, and we are part of creation when we bring a child into the world. It's just
absolutely
the fact of the matter.
Absolutely, but let's be real. God did most of the work, you know.
Oh, that's true.
You could say raising a human I would put a bit more emphasis on that. But even so, again, if we're raising people to be, you know, just to be good machines, then we're not better than a machine, and a machine can replace, you know, a malfunctioning machine. If you're raising a person to become a human, Adam, Dome Laboe, similar to the creator is the force of love and bestowal. He has this will to bestow, just to give. And you're the exact opposite. You're an egoistic creature. Why? You were created this way. Why? So you can receive all the goodness he had to give you. But you can't receive it, because if you were truly receiving what the creator wanted to give you, you would feel instant shame. Okay, it's like that moment. Again, we talked about analogies to this world. It's an analogous a little bit to when you really think about what your parents did for you, you can't stand that. You can't tolerate it. That's one of the reasons people don't want to really talk to their parents.
Yeah, well, that's why the relationship between a parent and child is different. The parent generally is more obsessed with the child, and the child kind of leaves their home and kind of we have this, we forget. We have an amnesia.
Right, and that's by nature. And that's by nature. But however, if you really stop and think about it, you wouldn't be able to live it yourself. If you really had a grasp of what a person, that person who gave birth to you, had to sacrifice for you to get to where you are. Right? Quarter of a century of their lives they gave to you, maybe even more in today's, with today's kids. So think about receiving from the creator who created all of this reality just for you to be able to come, to be able to feel him. You won't be able to stand it. We need to change our vessels from egoistic to altruistic. Now, you can't change your desire to receive. That's how you were made, but you can change the intention on top. And that's the difference. So the matter of creation, which is the desire, cannot be changed, but the intention, the form, the way in which you receive can change. It's the same as, again, to use a human example, sadly, that's the only examples we have. It's when you go to your mother, and you go to visit your mom, and you came from a meal with, you know, a business lunch, and then mom is like, hey, I made you your favorite Nadler soup. You're not going to say, I'm full. No, I said, yeah, sure.
Have you met my mother-in-law?
I didn't, but okay. It applies to every Jewish mother, probably all other mothers. Why? Because you're eating not because to fulfill yourself. You're eating in order to fulfill her, to give pleasure to her, because you feel how much she wants to bestow to you. She wants you to enjoy. You want her to enjoy. Now there's equivalence of form. Now you're sharing a pleasure on a whole other level. Not like the pleasure when you were a child and she gave you food. She enjoyed. You only enjoyed the food. You didn't enjoy her attitude. The Creator wants us to enjoy a higher form of pleasure, the pleasure of knowing the giver. And this is something that machines cannot do. And doing you know, mitzvahs like a machine and putting a mashgiach that's a machine, none of it is going to change any of that.
Okay,
for
first
you.
Of all, if I don't know why you say you're not religious. You're closet religious. You're in the closet.
I'm not closet religious. I think that
you have a deep soul, my friend.
I think I just have a different meaning again, which is I have to say, I'm not hiding it. I'm a student of Kabbalah, and I study from Baal HaSulam. So, you know, it's not some esoteric lineage. It's, you know, Abraham and Moses and Rashbi and the Ari and Baal Shem Tov and Baal Sulam and Rabash. That's my line. So,
I think what you're trying to say, one second, I just want to piggyback on what you said before we move on. What you're trying to say is that ultimately the machine could have chachma, it could have bina, but it doesn't have dat. Dat is the understanding. So even if a robot has sechel, if it has an intellectual capacity, if it has brain power, it's lacking that dat. And that's what Hashem wants from us. I come from Chabad. Chachma bina das is the three elements that it takes to actually reach that spiritual high, that we're on the highest level of connection to God. If you want to go into the spherot, you said you learned Kabbalah,
No, just stay on the corporeal level. Man, and a man knew his wife, right? To know your wife. That's already tells you what that is very
right.
Good.
Right. A robot can never attain the status of a human being for that reason. It can't. So it'll never perform religious functions. It'll never be part of a minyan. It'll never replace a shechet, because you have to come at it with all those three midos or components.
You have to have a different purpose, which the robot does not have. Also, it says, Tamu u kitov Hashem, right? It's you taste and see the Lord is good, the Creator is good, however you translate that. Taste and see, not read about it and see, not hear about it and see, not see a miracle and then no, taste and see, right? It's a flavor. You can't pass a flavor from one person to another. We can sit here, eat the same cake that your mother-in-law baked, and we'll have different flavors of that cake.
Different experiences.
Different experience, because those experiences are individual, they're unique, and the expansion of the light in your vessels, or any experience for that matter, which is generally referred to as light, any impression in your vessels is called light, right? Because it's like an illumination of sorts, not because it's light. Any experience like that will give you a taste, and it's that taste that makes everything really matter, right? Without the taste, without that pleasure, there's no reason to do anything. And so a machine, however great it is, however you code it to make the right conjectures,
it has no intention. It has no intention.
Exactly. There's no intention.
And by the way, that's a big part. That's a big part of halacha, because if you pass by a light that's on outside and you had no intention to turn on the light, it's not an issue. So, right. So that's a very important point. I think we could even almost wrap up on this, even though, honestly, we're going to have to do a follow-up episode because we didn't even scratch the surface. We didn't even scratch the surface. This is just like a morning coffee.
It's like a morning coffee.
Yeah, but when it comes down to it, I think it's all about our intention. And again, whether you're observant or not observant, that comes through. People recognize when your heart is in it, when you're completely übergegeben, given over, like you said, like a mother-in-law feeding her child, or mother. My mother would rather we eat a little less, but, you know, my mother-in-law loves to feed us. But when the intention is in it, you know, that's something that no robot could replace.
No robot can replace.
Wow.
But again, they could be made really good assistants. You just have to be careful. You have to know what to ask and how to ask it. So syntax, semantics, and context are really, really important. So just keep that in
mind. Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation. I think it's an exciting journey. I love it. I'm embracing it, obviously, with a little bit of wariness and hesitancy, as everyone else is. But, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, Shlomo HaMelech says. So if God created people with the capacity to create AI, I believe it has the potential to be something positive.
Yeah, why not? It'll just, don't tell anyone I told you, but it'll just help us reveal more, you know, quicker, reveal our egoistic nature and our need to change gears, to shift up.
Yeah.
So I'm actually very happy that
I like that. Up and up. We're on the up and up.
Yeah.
Leo, thank you so much. Nobody could replace me this morning in my house. I have to go take care. I got to go take care of the people, the little people here. But as the Chag begins, you know, we should all accept the Torah on whatever level we are ready for it and embrace it into our lives, incorporate the things that are meaningful to us.
We didn't say anything about Shavuot, right? This is a huge day.
It's a huge day. Like, you didn't prepare a Dvar Torah? You didn't prepare a little Chassidus Shavart?
I do have like a quote ready. If you want, I can bring a really really good.
Yala, let's do it quickly.
Please, okay, quickly.
I just love the idea of that we're like navigating this intersectionality of innovation and tradition. Like we can't escape it. We are Jews. Like that is the way we see the world. Like that is the lens through which we absorb everything. You know, all our Jewish teachings, ethics, the halacha, I mean, all of that can potentially be incorporated with artificial intelligence, but we're going to experience it so differently, again, from the lens of Torah. I think that's fantastic. All right, let's hear the vert.
Therefore, I remind you, above all, the relevance and importance of the love of friends at this time. On that depends our existence and in which our approaching success is measured. Therefore, move away from all the imaginary activities and dedicate your hearts to the thinking of thoughts and to the invention of the right inventions to truly connect all your hearts into one heart. And then you will literally realize the saying of love your friend as yourself.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I'm going to let you go. Leo, thank you so much. Have a Chag Sameach. And we're going to regroup and move this conversation forward. It was really fascinating.
Yes, and come listen to the Jew function.
I'm going to obviously.
Oh, you're going to plug.
I'm going to put links. Yeah. I'm going to plug that. I'm going to share that I was on the episode. We're going to share the episode. If you start surpassing me on the charts, I'm going to have to pull back, but I'm definitely going to let the people know where they can find you.
No way I can do better than how to never pay your first medical bill. I mean, there's
That is not
switch and bait.
Switch and bait, exactly. Clickbait.
Yeah, that's a great podcast. You know, that's my goal. I'll get to that. Ken Prasad, but take care.
So there you have it, episode 112 of the Weekly Squeeze. Don't forget to head over to my show notes links and order some Mosaic Press books. And I will see you next week, Thursday.